Time to begin our lecture on Austrian capital theory. I want to offer a certain disclaimer before we begin. My main general policy is no economics before 10 o'clock. I'm going the extra mile for the Mises Institute. That's how important the Mises Institute is for Western civilization. So we're going to do our best. One of the things I was not able to get to yesterday when I talked about the division of labor is that the division of labor itself is praxeologically linked with the capital structure. And so when we talk about the capital structure is like the other side of the division of labor coin, that we would not be able to have an extensive division of labor without an extensive capital structure, and the extensive capital structure is made possible by an extensive division of labor. So they go hand in hand, so it is appropriate that this lecture is following up to a certain extent on what I said before. Now, the Austrian capital theory is rooted in the work of Karl Menger and his exposition of the interrelationships of economic goods that Dr. Salerno discussed yesterday morning, where he lays out the distinction between consumer goods, or goods of the lowest order, as Menger would call it, and higher order goods, or producer goods. Consumer goods are those goods that are directly serviceable, that you can consume directly, you don't need to do anything. If you have a bottle of water and you drink it, you don't have to add anything to the water, you don't have to add water to get water. You just drink it, and that's a consumer good. A producer good, of course, is a good that it provides a service, it's helpful, but it doesn't provide direct satisfaction, direct utility, if you will. But it's used to produce something that will give you direct utility. And there are, in general, three categories, three large categories of producer goods. There are land and labor, we call the original factors. They are independently productive. Again, we don't have to do anything to manufacture labor. If we're here, we can use our labor. On the other hand, capital goods are another higher order good, and by definition, a capital good is a produced means of production. So a capital good is not independently productive. It has to be produced first and then can be used in production. If a carpenter wants to use a hammer, hammers don't literally grow on trees. They don't just sort of lay around, dropped by the hammer fairy or whatever overnight, and you just grab it. You know, you have to make the hammer first. It has to be produced, and then you can use the hammer. Now, each consumer good is made possible by its structure of production. And to make a consumer's good, the producer must obtain services of the higher order goods. The services of the necessary land, the necessary labor, and the necessary particular capital goods. And so let's go through an example. I think what a better way to illustrate this principle by considering what it takes to produce one of the pinnacles of Western civilization, which would be the flourless chocolate cake. It's perhaps, I consider it the greatest dessert in the history of Western civilization, which means the greatest dessert in the world. And it's so good. If you haven't ever had one, you have to have one. Put it on your bucket list. It's not something that you taste. It's something you experience. I'm not kidding. I'm prone to hyperbole, but I'm not being hyperbolic at this point. But ask yourself, okay, what does it take to produce something of this magnitude, right? Which on the other hand is only one little consumer good. Well, it takes land, of course, and labor. So you have this German pastry chef standing in a German kitchen. It takes a bowl and a spatula. It takes a pound of semi-sweet chocolate, a half a pound of butter, and 8 eggs. I told you it was good. I'm not making it up, right? You need a mixer, a KitchenAid stand-up mixer is probably the best, spring-form pan, you need a conventional oven, and you also need a microwave oven that I don't have here. Electricity would be good, or some type of power, but anyway, you need these higher-order goods that are used to make this flourless chocolate cake. Now, of course, you ask your question, okay, that's fine, that's great, right? Land and labor, they are original factors of production, but where do the eggs come from? How do we get the semi-sweet chocolate? How do we get the mixer? How do we get the oven? Well, they have to be produced. And so here we have, the print is relatively small, but here we have, and this just shows you how complex a structure production is. We have a structure production for flourless chocolate cake. Flourless chocolate cake, of course, is at the bottom here. And then above that, we have the land, the labor, the semi-sweet chocolate, the butter, the eggs, the electricity, the oven, the microwave oven, the springform pan, the mixer, the bowl, and the spatula. And I'm actually leaving a couple things out because I ran out of space. And this is, you know, too tiny as it is. But then you ask yourself, how do you get semi-sweet chocolate? Where does that come from? It doesn't grow on trees. No, to get semi-sweet chocolate, you need cocoa solids, cocoa butter, sugar, a factory, transport, land and labor. To get butter, you need raw milk, salt, a separator, tanks, a churner, packaging, a dairy plant, electricity, transport, land and labor. How do you get eggs? Right? Well, you need a chicken. Right? The chicken comes before the egg, by the way, in case there's any debate on this topic. You need a chicken. You need feed. You need a chicken coop. You need a water. Some automated equipment, if you're gonna, you know, if they're gonna really produce eggs at a price that we can all afford. You need electricity, a factory, transport, and labor. For electricity, you need power plants, coal or natural gas, wiring, land, and labor. For these other things, the oven, the microwave oven, the springform pan, the mixer, the bowl, and spatula, well, you can get those at your local kitchen supply shop. But where do they get their goods, right? They don't just sort of click their heels and have them appear, right? They have to be produced as well, right? And so to make an oven, you need a metal machine presses. You need automated equipment, electrical parts, plastic parts, enamel, insulation, hand tools, land and labor. Right? To make the springform pan, you need a metal machine, presses, automated equipment, etc. To make the mixer, you need zinc castings, metal parts, machines, paint, tools, electricity, electronic parts, a factory, land and labor. So at every stage of production, the producer obtains the services of the factors of production, and then they obtain them by purchasing them in exchange for money, right? And so let's suppose that we own a dessert shop. We'll call it Just Desserts. I always like shop names that have double meanings, right? Just Desserts. It's all we serve is desserts, and then we're going to give you your Just Desserts. And I know it's early. I'm doing the best I can. Just Desserts, in order to make the flourless chocolate cake that they are going to sell as a consumer good, they need to first spend money on the land, the labor, and all of these capital goods. And then the capital goods then is used in production to produce the low order good that Just Desserts sells as a consumer good. Likewise, the egg producer has to first advance money to the owners of higher order goods. They have to spend money on chickens and on chicken feed and on water and on the chicken coops, etc. They have to spend money there before they can then produce the eggs that then they will sell for money. And so this process, of course, begins clear at the top with the mining of the ores, the metal ores, the farming that's necessary to raise the chickens and the cows that are going to produce the milk. It begins with refining the metals and the zinc that is going to be used in the zinc casting and production of various other higher order goods. So this is actually, I mean, there's a lot of stuff up there, but this is a very, very simplified production structure. And by the way, if anyone everybody who is in the social sciences, political science, economics, sociology, if they are at all prone to consider, perhaps we need to engage in economic planning. Everybody in the social sciences should have somewhere along their line, pick your favorite consumer good and then trace out the entire structure of production for that consumer good. Just do it as an exercise. And by the time you get to the end, you should be all sort of be... You'll figure out that there is no way that we could plan the entire production apparatus for just one little slice of flourless chocolate cake. How are we going to do it for the rest of the economy, right? So I think it's a very helpful exercise. But in any event, as we look at this production structure, there are a couple of important principles that were mentioned by Dr. Celeno. We're just going to review again here. And one of those important principles is that effort moves down the structure of production. production effort moves down the structure of production, meaning we have to produce the higher order goods first, right? I mean, we can't make the flourless chocolate cake without the eggs or without the butter. We don't make the flourless chocolate cake and then get some butter to use to make the flour. We can't do that. We have to have the butter first, which means we have to have the raw milk in the churn first before we make the butter. To make the mixer, we have to have the zinc castings first, which means the zinc has to be mined first. Right? And so the production has to begin at the higher stages, and then production effort moves down to the stage of the lowest order, the consumer goods stage. On the other hand, value and income is imputed up the structure of production. Why is it that people produce eggs at all anyway? Well, it's because people want them to consume directly, but then also to use to make flourless chocolate cakes, to make flourful cakes, and other things, right? Omelets. Why is it that people produce mixers? Because mixers can be used to produce other things that people value. And so if, for instance, the value of, if people take complete leave of their senses and they said, I don't want any flourless chocolate cake ever again, right? that'd be no way to make America great again, by the way. But if that happens, right, the value of semi-sweet chocolate would fall significantly, right? It wouldn't all go away, right? Because some people, there are other uses for semi-sweet chocolate, but it would fall significantly. And so it would be less valuable. There would be less incentive for semi-sweet chocolate producers to produce as much semi-sweet chocolate because there would be less revenues being reaped by the producer of semi-sweet chocolate because people would be buying less of it. And so people value the higher order goods because of the value of the lower order goods. We call that derived demand. And likewise, as people make investments, the income is moving up the structure of production. The flourless chocolate cake producers spend money to obtain the higher order goods, to obtain the butter, the springform pan, and the spatula. The spatula maker spends money to obtain the silicone and the molds and the presses necessary to make the spatula, right? And so income, the direction of income is moving up the structure of production. Now, those producers who use money to invest in the purchase of factors of production are called capitalists because it's a time transaction. People, these capital goods producers, they spend money, they advance money in time to owners of higher order goods producers. And then they take those factors and produce the capital good, and then they will sell the capital good to the person who's demanding it at the next stage. And so every act of production like that is a time transaction. The producer advances money to the owners of the factors of production in order to obtain the factors to produce a good that they're going to sell for money, hopefully, but in the future. Right? So there's a present future dimension throughout the production structure. Now the fact then that all production takes time, each producer must produce. Each producer of a good must produce in anticipation of the sale of a product. And any investment in the production of a good is made in anticipation of a later sale to lower owner producers or eventually to consumers. Now, we've made this point that if you notice, the bulk of the goods listed on this very simplified production structure, the bulk of these goods are capital goods. They're produced means of production. So the complex structure of production that we have supporting any consumer good is made possible only by the use of capital goods, by produced means of production. And using capital goods requires longer production processes. Using capital goods requires longer production processes. It requires adding stages to the production process. Because in order to obtain a capital good, you have to forego direct satisfaction. You have to forego consumption. If you want to buy, for instance, a standing mixer to use making flourless chocolate cake and pizza dough and other culinary delights, you have to first be willing to sacrifice the money that you would spend on the KitchenAid mixer. You have to do without some other good, right? A consumer good. This is a drift trike. Drift trikes are becoming a thing, it turns out. Like trikes for adults, I guess. Literally, that's what I've seen in the pictures anyway. Hey, value subjective, whatever. And so one, if one has $500 just sort of laying around, they could spend it on a drift trike and get direct satisfaction from that. Or they could spend it on KitchenAid, a KitchenAid mixture that you're going to use to produce some other consumer good. So what do we have? We have a situation where the person who's going to obtain the capital good has to forego present consumption. And this sacrificing the restriction of present consumption is what we call saving. It's called saving. So obtaining and accumulating capital requires saving. It requires the restriction of consumption. And then, of course, we're not restricting consumption for restriction of consumption's sake. Those savings are going to be directed to accumulating capital goods. And so when people save their resources, when they direct those resources to the accumulation of capital goods, that's called investment. Right? So save and investment go together. So people save, they restrict consumption in order to invest. But if they're restricting consumption, that means that they're going to be doing it without some present satisfaction. They're going to be reducing their present satisfaction at some level. Why would they do that? Why go to all this trouble just to, you know, get your hands on a couple of capital goods? Well, it's because capital goods increase productivity. They increase productivity for the user. And they do so in two ways. Right? The first way is they increase the productivity in tasks we can do without capital goods, right? You can imagine that it's possible to, say, beat eggs with your fingers. You could crack, you know, 8 eggs in a bowl and just kind of go to town. But, I mean, you could do that, right? I'll be honest, it's not as effective as using a mixer. It takes a lot of hand motion, and you have to move your hands real fast. And at some point, you begin to suffer from carpal tunnel syndrome. So it's not easy, right? It's a whole lot easier to put in the eggs in a bowl and just hitting the button and let the capital good do its work, right? And it's even better because you put those eggs in the bowl and let the capital goods, while that's doing its thing, you can go over and put the, you can have the chopped up semi-sweet chocolate and the butter in the bowl and put it in the microwave while the eggs are going, right? So you're essentially doubling your labor in some sense. That's how capital goods increase productivity. Right? They allow us to produce goods that we can produce without a capital good. More importantly, however, capital goods increase our productivity because it allows people to produce goods that otherwise we could not obtain at all. Right? Here is a photo of ancient man. I don't know who the photographer was, but they happened to catch some ancient men fishing in their dugouts, and they're thrusting their hands down into the water. And as the commentary says, before the hook, the pole, and the worm were even thought of, there existed a time known to fish as the Golden Age. Right? And why is that? Because they can't catch fish just by, you know, grabbing their fists down in a pond, right? They need capital goods. They need a pole, a hook, a bow and an arrow or something, right? They need a capital good, right? And so there are certain goods that we flat out could not have at all without capital goods. I mean, think of what we have here, that projector, right? The projector, the laptop computers, the smartphones. We would not have those at all if we did not have capital goods. My glasses, you would all be fuzzy if it wasn't for capital goods, because we need capital goods to make glasses. And so there are a whole host of goods that we now look at not even as luxuries, but as necessities that we would not have without capital goods. And so capital goods increase our productivity. In fact, the role of capital is to advance people in time towards their objective in producing a consumer's good. It helps us to achieve our end more quickly. If I had to mix the eggs by hand, it would take quite a long time to do that. And then when I got done, I still would have to take care of the chocolate and the butter and melt them together. But now with the KitchenAid mixer, as I said, you press it, it whips it up real nice in about 4 minutes, and that gives you just the right amount of time to melt the chocolate and to melt the butter. I feel like a little bit like Julia Child. I don't know. I'm giving like cooking instructions. I'm sorry. First you take the chocolate. No. Anyway, so So the role of capital advances us in time. It allows us to achieve our end more quickly. So what keeps people from investing more and more resources in capital goods? If capital goods are so, you know, if they help us to be so productive, why don't we just do nothing but invest? Well, it's because of what we call time preference, right? People prefer to have their ends satisfied sooner than later, and one of their ends is a satisfaction from consumption. At some point, people will value the present good more than the same amounts in than some amount of goods in the future. Right? People do have to eat to survive. If you're going to produce, you have to survive. And so, at some point, you're not going to invest 100% of your income or either in terms of goods or money in investment because you have to eat. So the intensity of preferring present money to future money or present goods to future money, the intensity or the level of time preference, that determines how willing people are to save and invest. People with relatively high time preferences, they want present satisfaction now, and so they're less willing to put off present consumption. They're less willing to save and invest. On the other hand, people with lower time preferences, they still have time preference, but it's not as intense. They're more willing to put off some of their present satisfaction to obtain more capital goods, to consume more in the future. Right? So time preference is very important. Now that leads us to the question of what kind of capital goods and how many capital goods do we accumulate? Choices related to capital goods, right? And one dimension that we have a choice about, we can arrange production in a more or less capital-intensive process, right? If we say, we're not going to mix eggs with our fingers, we still have a wide variety of choices to choose from. We can use a fork. You can beat eggs with a fork. You can use a spatula, which is even better. You can use a hand mixer. In fact, the original recipe that I use, I recommend the recipe from Cook's Illustrated for a flourless chocolate cake. It's called the Ultimate Flourless Chocolate Cake, and they're not kidding. So this is a little tip from Dr. Rittenour to you all. They recommend using a hand mixer if you can't be more capital intensive. Use a hand mixer and then put it on books, sort of have a makeshift standing mixer. Right, that is okay, but it's better to have an actual standing mixer. Now, if you could go whole hog and have an industrial standing mixer, I mean, this thing is about that mixer there, clear on the right there for you. That has about, oh my goodness, about 30. This is about 30 times bigger than that bowl, just to give you some perspective on it. That's huge, right? And so this, from left to right, is different levels of capital intensity. Which one is right for the producer? Well, it depends on the preferences of the producer. It becomes a choice variable, right? A producer is not forced in a free society. He's not forced just to use one type of capital good, right? There's a range of capital goods, and it's determined by his preferences. Also, each capital good has a different degree of specificity. Think of eggs and springform pans, right? Of those two, the springform pan that's what's up there in the top right. The springform pan is is more specific, right? Springform pan only has fewer uses than eggs. Eggs you use eggs for a whole lot of things. You can eat them, you could eat them raw. I've been told Rocky Balboa drank them raw before he, beat Apollo Creed, so I guess they're pretty good. You can fry them. You can fry them sunny side up. You can scramble them. You can use them in an omelet. You can use a flourless chocolate cake. You can use a regular cake. You can use them in cookies. You could use them as a weapon. You can use a springform pan as a weapon too. But you don't hear that about that a lot. But there's a whole host of uses for eggs. Eggs are relatively less specific than springform pans. And I would suggest that milk chocolate on the bottom there, the milk chocolate on the left, is probably less specific than semi-sweet chocolate on the right. I don't know if that's true, but there are different levels of specificity. Right? And that's also then something that needs to be taken into account. And it can be that sort of ups the ups the risk factor a little bit. If you use a factor that's more specific, If the demand for the good that you're producing goes away, the value of that capital good will shrink more than the good that's less specific. Right? For instance, if the demand for flourless chocolate cakes fall, right, the value of springform pans would fall more by a larger magnitude than the demand or than the value of eggs, because eggs have a whole lot more uses. So the degree of specificity is something that you have to figure out, something you have to choose. Right? Another choice variable is the durability of the capital good. This also needs to be chosen, because all capital goods are perishable. There's no capital good that lasts forever. They get used up, and this rate at which a capital good gets used up is called depreciation, the rate of depreciation. And so each particular good has a different rate at which it is used up. It has a different duration of serviceability. Eggs, for instance. Eggs used to make a cake are used up just like that. You crack the eggs and you put them in the bowl, that's it, right? You can't somehow start mixing the eggs and then say, oh, wait a minute, I didn't mean to do that. I'm going to extract the eggs out of the flourless chocolate cake batter and use them for my omelet. You can't do that, right? So eggs get used up very quickly. The oven, on the other hand, can last for, 15, 20 years, right? And so different capital goods have different durations of serviceability. In this case, the spatulas, right? This is a spatula. On the one hand, the spatula seems like it's a two-piece spatula. It looks relatively more flimsy, less durable than the other spatulas that are pure whole silicone that are, you look like you could just, bang the snot out of your kitchen with one of those things, and they'd still, take a licking and keep on ticking, to quote an old Timex watch commercial. Right? Regardless, capital goods wear out, or they become obsolete. And so if someone invests money in, say, spatulas, they spend some money on a spatula, and they're using it, right? At some point it wears out. And once the capital good wears out, they're back to where they started, with your fingers, right? And so what do you have to do? Well, in order to maintain the productivity that you get with an initial capital good, the producer has to save over the period of time that he uses that producer good to make a good that he's going to sell for money. He has to save so that he has enough savings to invest in replacing the old capital good after it wears out. And if he's saving just enough to replace the old capital goods as they wear out, we call that maintaining capital. They're maintaining capital. On the other hand, to increase his productivity, right? If you got one spatula, so well, if I had a second spatula, then I could make many flourless chocolate cakes in a row, right? Because after I get done with making one or two, The one spatula is so gummed up with chocolate goodness, right? Then I'll put that in the dishwasher, and I'll use the second spatula. I can just keep going, right? And so that increases my productivity. But what does that mean? That requires two spatulas, which means even more saving, right? More saving than just enough to replace the first spatula when it wears out. We have to save even more, so now we can accumulate two spatulas and two KitchenAid mixers and two kitchens, right? So when businesses expand their operations, they're accumulating capital that requires even more saving and investment. And then, of course, on the other hand, we could consume capital. We could just, invest in these spatulas, the eggs, and the semi-sweet chocolate, and just use them up once, not save at all, blow all of our proceeds on bubblegum, cotton candy, and satellite TV, and smartphones, and TikTok, and Snappy Chat, and... And what do we have left to show for it? Well, we get a little boost of present consumption satisfaction, and then we're going to be less productive going forward, because we have less capital, we have fewer capital goods with which to work. And so the good news, if your goal is to consume capital, you basically don't have to do anything except consume, right? But that'll allow you to live a little high on the hog for a short period of time, but then your productivity will fall, you'll be less productive, your income will fall, and you will be relatively impoverished. So adding to capital and maintaining capital require saving of a certain threshold. Right? Now, the choice of whether or not to save or invest, the choice of how much to save and invest, ultimately then the choice to accumulate, maintain, or consume capital depends on how much a person values present goods over future goods. Again, it depends on time preference. The capitalist must decide whether or not to restrict consumption now in order to increase consumption in the future. And that decision depends on two things. It depends on the value of the good being produced. Right? How valuable is getting a flourless chocolate cake or revenue from selling flourless chocolate cakes in the future? How valuable is that just in general? And then also, what is my rate of time preference? Right? Let's suppose that if I put off present consumption for a couple of weeks, I figure I can make enough flourless chocolate cakes that I can sell over the 2-week period for a certain sum of money. I don't know how much it would be. I haven't really thought it out. Maybe $3,000. It's going to be a great bake sale. And then I have to ask myself, well, but is all of this, I could be consuming a lot with the money I'm going to have to spend on my factors of production to get $3,000 in 2 weeks. Is it worth it? Well, maybe not. Maybe I can't do without my drift trike. I can't. I just can't. And so I'm not going to be willing to make that investment. And so people's time preference, the rate of time preference, and the value of the product produced are the things that will affect whether or not a person's willing to save and invest in a particular line of production. Now, this is just all the basics of principles related to the structure of production, basically for one little good. And it's a little good, but it's an important little good, the flourless chocolate cake. But the entire economy, of course, this may not be news to you. There are more consumer goods than flourless chocolate cake that exists, right? There's a lot of consumer goods, which means there are a lot of production processes. I mean, just think about that. Think about how complex the production structure for a flourless chocolate cake is, and then just magnify that for the veritable plethora of consumer goods that exist. It is, as I've heard one politician say, it's huge. Right? It's amazing. Right? It is it's tremendous. And the entire economic order in which we live, the entire market division of labor, consists of one integrated, complex production structure. And that's the macroeconomy, what we call the macroeconomy. And as we consider the macroeconomy from the perspective of praxeology, from the perspective of realistic human action, and the fact that action has to take place in time, so all production is a time-intensive process using a myriad of a variety of different consumer producer goods and capital goods and land and labor, we see the distinction between, shall we say, the modern approaches to macro and to the Austrian approach to macro. Modern macro, you can look at, it's sort of divided up into two or three. There's more to it than just this, but there's only so much time that a person has. You know, the Keynesian view, right, where the economy is why. Why? Because we like it. I don't know. Y is equal to C plus I plus G, and if you want to get sophisticated, plus NX, net exports, right? Well, where does capital show up there? Well, it shows up in the big I, right? It's just a flow of spending, right? You spend more on I, you get more Y. Right? If you spend less Y, you get less I, you get less Y, right? And for Keynes, the secret to the fluctuations in the economy is fluctuations in the volatile I, right? I think it's what, I think Garrison Helpful notes, it's the animal spirits model, right? When the animal spirits are woohoo, we invest a lot and Y goes up, and then when the mania wears off, we're kind of sad, and we go in the other direction, and the animal spirits, it's bad juju, and so then we have business depressions, and there is no rhyme or reason. It's just animal spirits, but all of the spending is just in the eye. So the more capital spending in general, who cares how we spend it, the better off we'll be. The neoclassical growth model is a macro model that's used a lot. And there we have capital is in that little KT, right? output in time t is equal to at times a function of capital and labor. So output's a function of capital and labor. A is this sort of amorphous, I think A is for amorphous, actually, a production shift variable, that anything that affects how productive the capital and labor is, then it goes up and down. But the capital itself is K, right? And I don't think it actually is just coincidence that they signify K, a capital with a K, as in capital, as in das Kapital. I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong here. But K is for capital. And it's just a homogeneous blob of shmoo, right? Well, all of that, those views of capital in macroeconomics obscures all of the insights of the Austrian structure of production. The fact that the capital goods, you know, are actually heterogeneous. They're very different. There's a lot of difference between a spatula and a pound of semi-sweet chocolate. There's a lot of difference between a microwave oven and 8 eggs. There's a lot of difference between a half pound of butter and a springform pan. There's a lot of difference between all of those goods and electricity. So capital goods are heterogeneous with different uses, different specificities, different durations of serviceability. And those capital goods, to produce a flourless chocolate cake, the goods don't just have to exist somewhere, sometime, right? It's not as if, you know, somewhere there's a place for us, somewhere. No, to be useful, to make a flourless chocolate cake, you have to have the chocolate, the eggs, the spatula, the pans, the ovens in your kitchen, at the right time. Right? Having them someday, somewhere, is not going to help you. Right? And so the capital goods have to be in the right place at the right time, in the right combination, with other complementary factors to be productive. All of those things are necessary for production to take place, for economic progress to occur. And all of those factors are obscure when you say capital is I or capital is K. Now, the general economic order is an integrated aggregate production structure that supports the production of all consumer goods. And that's what we get in the Austrian tradition. 20th century Austrians such as Hayek and Rothbard and Roger Garrison and Jesus Huerta de Soto have represented the Austrian capital structure as a Hayekian triangle, named after Hayek because I think he used it first. Roger Garrison famously put it on its side. More recently, it seems I remember other contemporary Austrians such as Peter Lewin and others, I think referring to the work of Ludwig Lachmann, said that maybe it's better to represent capital as a web, right? Because it's, in some sense, in their minds, it's not purely purely linear. For instance, let's suppose, you know, most of these producers of the miners, the refiners, KitchenAid, the springform pan producer, the dessert shop, they're going to use personal computers. Well, so is a personal computer a first-stage capital good, a second-stage capital good, or a 10th-stage capital good? Right? Well, it depends on the computer, right? It depends on where the computer is used. It's dependent upon, you know, where a good fits into the structure of production is dependent upon the subjective use of the user, right? Semi-sweet chocolate could be a consumer good for some people. It has been for me on occasion. It's also a producer good. It depends on how it's used, right? And so those people that want to focus on that aspect say, well, maybe the capital structure is better thought of as a web, not as a linear sort of triangle from the higher stages to the lower stages. I sort of understand what the point they're trying to make, but in reality, the fact is that the economic import of a capital good is always going to be a capital good, whatever the good is, the specific good is always going to be placed at some order, either nearer or farther away from consumption. And so I don't think there's anything about the Hayekian triangle that makes it, less useful than the concept of conceiving of capital good, you know, capital structure as an interlocking web. The main point is simply that capital is not best represented as simply a stock of goods in general, nor a flow of expenditure in general. Capital, if we want to get it right, we have to remember that the capital structure is a structure in which all the parts are interrelated with one another. And they are interrelated with one another through production decisions that are made at every stage of production. Now, the same principles that apply to the individual production process for a flourless chocolate cake apply to all production processes throughout the entire economic order, the entire macroeconomy. Throughout the entire economic order, money moves from the consumer goods industries up through the higher stages of production. At the same time, production effort begins in the form of goods flowing from the highest stages down to the lower orders of production, culminating in the production of all the consumer goods. And at any given moment in our economic order, there is production activity occurring simultaneously at the various stages of the production structure. Right now, somebody is mining zinc that will later be used for making zinc castings. And right now, somebody is making zinc castings that will be used to make a KitchenAid mixer. And right now, KitchenAid mixers are being made that will be used by some thankful soul to make a flourless chocolate cake in the future. And right now, somewhere, someone is making a flourless chocolate cake that they're going to be able to eat tomorrow and experience gastronomical bliss. And so this production it's not as if, okay, we all start, producing only higher order goods, and 10 years from now, that's the only time we're going to get consumer goods. No, the production structure is such that there's production going simultaneously at all of these different stages. And at the lowest stages, producers of consumer goods exchange their products for money. Money moves up from consumers to the supply of consumer goods, from consumers to the suppliers of consumer goods. And the producers of capital goods invest their income, and they invest their income in higher order land, labor, and capital goods, and so on and so forth. Now, as we consider the capital structure, three important facts are brought out to bear. One, production of the entire economy is heavily weighted to production of capital goods. Heavily weighted to the production of capital goods. The amount of money spent on capital goods is much higher than the amount of money spent on consumer goods. You think about all the money in the economy that's spent on, eggs, semi-sweet chocolate, butter, electricity, ovens, metal, refining, mining, all of that stuff, for all of the consumer goods that are being produced, more money spent on capital goods than on consumer goods. So the entire, and this is the key, the entire structure of production then is supporting by saving and investment, not consumption. It is not consumption that drives the economy. It is not consumption that makes the economy possible. It is true that all of the producer goods, all the acts of production is driven towards eventual consumption. But what drives the economy, what makes consumption possible, is production. And so it's saving and investment that drives the economy, not the other way around. Another important principle is that the capitalist, the one that saves and invests, is the laborer's benefactor by advancing income to present workers. It's the capitalist, through his investment, that sustains workers through their time-consuming process. The Empire State Building, you may have heard of it. It's been in all the newspapers. The Empire State Building, they began work on it on June 22nd, 1930. It was not finished, and it didn't open until May 1st, 1931. Pretty fast when you think about it. But it was, 11 months for them to finish, right, before they could accept any tenants and make any money. So suppose you're going to say, hey, I'd like you to come work. I'd like you to start excavation for this. But the bad news is you're not going to get paid for a year. The worker's thinking, I've got a wife and four children. How am I going to support my children? Well, that's not my problem. I will give you money when we get money. No, the capitalist invests. He advances money to the worker. Here again, there's not conflict between the capitalist and the laborer. They work together, right? The laborer supplies a service. The capitalist receives income that allows him to sustain himself and his family. And so the capitalist is the laborer's benefactor. Also, the economic order is extremely complex. It is beyond the capability to design and plan the production structure for a single capital or a single consumer good. It's estimated that there are several million types of consumer goods produced in the U.S. economy. It is simply far beyond the capability of the human mind to comprehend, let alone design, an entire production process that's going to be economically sound, that's going to allow producers to actually economize, to utilize the scarce factors of production to produce the goods that the people want, that they really, really want. The zig-a-zig-ah, so to speak. And so anybody that says, oh, we can easily sort of plan this is living in a fantasy world. That's why we need entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs, using market prices of various capital goods, can then estimate the capital value of the goods and the capital values of firms. And so that's why what Sandy Klein talked about yesterday, the monetary price nexus is the connection between capital goods and the economic concept of capital that is a tool of economic calculation. And which is why Mises is right when he says that capitalism only exists and works. Capital only makes sense in a market with free market prices, which is why it makes sense to refer to the free market as capitalism. It's not cronyism. It's capitalism, because we need those free market prices to use to calculate the capital values of the specific capital goods, to sum up the capital values of the goods, to obtain the capital value for the firm, and then have the entrepreneur decide, should I produce this or that? Should I invest in this line of production or that line of production? Right. It's the use of economic calculation that makes the capital structure and the division of labor a social order and not social chaos. And I'm over time, so I'll stop now. Thank you very much for your attention.